above his shoulder and ready for a downward strike. The wave of heat coming out of his body with every step he took in slow motion dissipated all the cold he had been feeling. He propelled his body forward like a bullet, teeth gritted with effort, clouds of sand rising with every step he took. He was vaguely aware that Kes hadn't bothered to raise her own sword. She had left her arm hanging limply by her side and instead had raised her right hand in front of her like it was a weapon itself. He was upon her so fast that he had no time to process this information. He was committed now. Only then did Kes move. She took a lateral step toward him just as his arms initiated the arc of his sword strike, and she struck his right arm an inch below his wrist. Ed watched all this happen in slow motion, at just the right speed to be unable to do anything about it. This stopped his sword before it had gained enough speed to be dangerous. His own momentum carried him forward, and he thought he would smash into Kes and bring her down. Instead, Kes shifted her own body to catch his weight with one shoulder while at the same time pushing Ed's arm over her head, adding to his momentum and robbing him of any smidgen of control he could have regained. She pushed with her shoulder, bending her body like a branch. Ed barely had time to yell in surprise when his feet left the ground. His improved reflexes ended just in time for him to register a dizzying blur of movement, and then air rushed out of his lungs and he was flat on his back, a small cloud of dust surrounding his body. He coughed, tried to roll away from the source of pain, and then a heavy boot on his chest stopped any recovery attempts. His sword had fallen somewhere out of his reach, and he was seeing stars. The tip of a wooden sword appeared among those stars. He stared at it like a drunk man until his mind recovered enough to tell him that the sword owner was Kes, and that he had been defeated. Outside the ring, Ed heard Alder's voice saying,
"Late as holy tits. You saw that?"
"No,"
whispered Levy.
"Ouch,"
Kleck muttered softly. Kes moved her sword away and lent Ed a hand so he could stand up.
"Are you okay?"
Kes asked. Ed wanted to joke and ask if someone had written down the number of the truck. Instead, what came out of his mouth sounded more like,
"Gah."
He shook his head, cleared his throat of rogue particles of sand, and tried again.
"I think so."
"You activated your reflexes too soon,"
Kes advised.
"If you wished to take me by surprise, you should have used them at the last possible second. Next time, close the distance first."
"But you already expected that," Ed said.
"Yes, yet you decided to attack anyway. If you are going to try a desperation maneuver, then fully commit to it. Otherwise, you aren't desperate enough. You lacked confidence in yourself."
Ed felt his ears burn hot with shame. He stole a glance outside the ring, toward his friends. At least they weren't laughing. Actually, they seemed to be busy dreading the same ass-kicking happening to them when their turn came. If he faltered now, it had encouraged them to falter too, and it would endanger their lives later on. He picked up his sword. Kes nodded approvingly and raised hers.
"Whenever you're ready."
This time, Ed waited to activate his reflexes. Instead of disarming him in a single hit like the last time, Kes parried his strikes without counterattacking, letting him try to break her defenses. As she did so, she threw glances at his feet, elbows, shoulders, and waist, scowling all the time with a focused expression. Ed realized she was analyzing his fighting skills in very much the same way he had studied her character sheet, all while fending him off. She wasn't liking what she found. Ed kicked his efforts up a notch, trying everything he could to make his sword come down as fast and as unpredictably as possible, and every time she parried and diverted him without issue. Most of the time, she shifted around him as she did so, her feet moving so fast they were a blur. Despite her speed, Kes's steps were always purposeful and solid. She didn't dance around him. Her movements weren't gracious, but Spartan and stoic, intended to offer Ed a bad angle for his sword and give her a perfect arc to riposte from every parry. At no point during their fight did she ever remain in the same place. It forced Ed to flail and jump around just to try to keep her in front of him. Ed soon found himself out of breath. The instant that his movements slowed, he was sitting on his ass, his sword having mysteriously flown away from his hands.
That's enough,
said Kes. She lowered her own weapon and again helped him stand up. Ed dusted himself off while he tried to regulate his heartbeat. His forehead was covered in sweat. The mercenary scratched her chin for a moment, like she was putting together the pieces of information she had garnered.
You lack anything that even approximates proper fighting technique. Your footwork is atrocious, too. Your cardiovascular capacity is lacking, and you need to strengthen your legs and abdomen.
Ed realized that Kes didn't mean any of it as an insult, but as a mere statement of fact, like saying that water is wet. In a way, Ed found it refreshing. Had Kes tried to care for his feelings, it would have been patronizing. Instead, she was merely a teacher correcting her student. But now she was scratching her chin.
It makes no sense, though,
she said.
You clearly have an idea of what a longsword is supposed to do, so you must have seen one before. And yet, had you seen a sword fight, you'd have realized that your current movements don't work. It's like someone trained you wrong as a joke.
Ed had no way of explaining fancy action movies to her without spending the rest of the day on it. So he simply shook his head, dejected. After Kes was finished with Ed, she had Alder step up into the ring. The bard gulped and glanced nervously in Ed's direction as the dungeon lord swept away the sand from his trousers with a pained expression. Ed caught Alder's gaze and gave him a thumbs up. Alder nodded, took a deep breath, and bravely went for his dose of ass-kicking. His weapon of choice was a wooden short sword and a shield. He made sure to leave his flute safely tucked near the weapon rack before he actually entered the ring. Unlike Ed, Alder had seen a proper sword fight happen in real life. He approached Kes carefully, his shield positioned between the two and his sword half hidden behind it, trying to mask his attack until the last chance. Kes waited until she was almost within his reach, then neatly sidestepped into Alder's lunge and pushed his shield into his body before he had a chance to react. The bard lost his footing and lowered his blade as he cursed loudly and tried to counterattack Kes at the same time that he tried to fix his shield's positioning. Instead of managing any of that, he ended flat out on his ass.
If you are going to use a shield,
Kes told him while she helped him stand up,
make sure you actually have the strength to keep it where it's supposed to go.
I'm a lover, Alder complained, not a fighter.
Steel goes through lovers just as well as fighters,
Kes snapped back. She raised her sword.
Again!
Watching the fight, if it could be called that, from afar was a very different experience than being in the ring. Ed watched over and over again as his friend tried and failed to hit Kes. Ed winced at every misstep and at every potentially deadly counterattack that Kes chose not to deliver. When Alder stepped out of the ring, groaning and covered in sand, Ed didn't feel like joking around. He couldn't help but imagine what would have happened had Alder, or Ed himself, faced Ranger Ione or Inquisitor Galio in close combat. Alder reached Ed's side and the both of them exchanged a nod, like two veterans of some terrible war greeting each other at the bar. Levy caught this exchange and gulped audibly.
Do I have to?
She asked softly.
Try to land on your arse and roll with the impact, Alder told her. It hurts less that way.
The witch selected a spear with a round tip for her weapon and stepped into the ring.
You wouldn't hurt a lovely young lady, would you, Kes?
Levy offered the mercenary her best smile. As a response, Kes calmly grabbed the spear that Levy was shaking in her direction and pulled hard, which made Levy lose her footing as well as her hold on the spear. She stumbled into Kes's reach with a terrified expression. The spear flashed around in Kes's hand and she used it to sweep Levy off her feet.
Ah, she didn't listen to my advice,
Alder muttered to himself as he winced in sympathy.
I don't think she had time, Ed said.
Levy didn't bother to stand up.
I surrender.
There's no surrender,
Kes told her darkly. She prodded the witch's ribs with the tip of her training sword.
There's only me.
A few minutes later, Levy was out of the ring and standing next to Ed. The three trainees looked a good bit worse for the wear. Ed nursed his elbow, Alder's hair was dirty with sand, and Levy had a thousand-yard stare and wouldn't answer when spoken to. Kes paced before them like a lioness studying her prey.
There's much work that needs to be done,
she was saying.
I'm afraid all of you have terrible fundamentals, and I can't train you in combat before we fix that. Otherwise, you'll develop bad habits that will get you killed sooner rather than later.
She nodded to herself, paused to think for a moment, and turned to face them.
First of all, we'll work on your endurance and brawn. Those attributes need to be at least a 10. No excuses. Normally, it's not efficient to train them both at the same time, but you three are so abysmally untrained that we can start with both and specialize later on.
She listed the exercises that they would do every morning of every day for the next several weeks. Starting tomorrow, they'd run outside for an hour, following Kes's pace, and then they'd come back to the training center where she'd instruct them in the exercises required to strengthen their bodies. Kes finished her speech and stared at them with a stern gaze.
Any questions?
What did I do to deserve this?
Alder asked. It was a question that Kes didn't bother answering. Levy continued staring at nothing. Her eye twitched a bit.
If it isn't a problem, I'd like you to trade me too,
Kleck said timidly. The mercenary stared at the Batblin with an inscrutable expression.
Kleck,
she said.
You can't expect to be on the front lines and survive.
Her voice was stern, but Ed knew the mercenary well enough to see that her eyes had softened. Kleck nodded.
Yes, but I've a title to live up to. I'm the Ranger Slayer. I must do my absolute best to protect my cloud. I want my father to feel proud of me.
The cloud was the name the Batblins had for their clan. Kleck's cloud, led by Druzb, had become Ed's minions shortly after Kes had joined the group, and now they lived on the outskirts of the dungeon. They provided most of the food consumed by the dungeon's inhabitants. They were also assholes, and when Ed had first met them, they had almost lynched Levy and Alder, and they had abandoned Kleck to die when things didn't go their way.
Very well. I'll train you as hard as everyone else, Ranger Slayer.
She then turned to the three humans.
And you? I expect every single one of you to put as much effort as Kleck will into his training.
She glared at them sternly.
Or else!
Chapter 4 Open Locks. Ed left the training center, followed by Alder and Levy. Kleck and Kes went in the opposite direction, headed for the outside world. The Batblin would supervise the foraging efforts of his cloud, while Kes planned to visit Andrina and see if the herbalist could come up with a brew to help with the training. For all his effort fighting Kes, he had managed to gain a single rank in untrained combat, which didn't bode well for the amount of effort he'd need to raise his attributes and learn real fighting skills. Although, if becoming stronger were easy, everyone would be.
I don't understand,
Levy said while the three humans were alone.
She only has 100 experience points more than you do, Ed. How can she be so strong? In the grand scheme of things, 100 experience points is not that much of a difference.
They were the first words Levy had spoken since her ass-kicking.
It's the difference between experience points and actual, real experience, Ed said at last. She has training and combat experience to back her up, and since her skills and attributes are higher, she has access to an array of talents that fit her style. She knows how to use those talents to their full extent and has the physical fortitude to handle the energy expenditure.
But,
Levy went on,
then why does she have so few experience points? Kale had at least 1,000. If Kes was a soldier, she must have fought in a war, killed other soldiers. If she survived enough battles, I can't imagine why she doesn't have thousands of experience points.
Ed mulled this over. To be honest, he had wondered something similar himself back when he first arrived in Ivalis. He didn't fully understand the way experience points worked. Many situations had earned him a bunch of points, but similar situations had given him almost none. He had earned almost 100 points during the Battle of Barova, but not a single one over the following days.
Oh, said Alder, I know the reason. It's the idiot or carpenter correlation.
Beg your pardon? Ed asked.
It's a bardic thing.
Alder shrugged. He traced an imaginary line in the air and pointed at one extreme.
Idiot goes here. Carpenter goes on the other end.
Alder, I really don't follow,
Levy said, clearly as confused as Ed was.
The bard smiled when he realized he had the rapt attention of his audience. As you may know, the way objectivity grants experience points is a correlation between the risk incurred and the experience points of the being you just killed. A spiderling has like 5 experience points, but normally a single one is no risk for any human, so you'll earn no points for stomping one. But if you have never seen a spiderling before, and it's late at night, and there are a lot of them, then you'll probably earn some points. The full 5 for your first kill, and a reduced amount for each one after that, until you're earning 0 just like the rest of us.
Alder's hands followed his words like he was trying to paint a picture for Levy and Ed.
There are, of course, other modifiers. If you're fighting in a group, the amount of experience points will be divided between each member of the group, and objectivity will grant each member a different amount according to their personal risk, and so on. Luck, for example, takes away a big chunk of points if you manage to kill something too risky for you. In no case will you get more points than what the creature you killed had in the first place. In Elytra, my teachers call this the EXP Law of Conservation, after Professor Everett Zarlander Painter, who first proposed it in—
Back on topic, please,
Levy demanded. Alder stopped dead in his tracks, gave Levy the stink eye, and then realized he'd forgotten what he was saying in the first place.
Yes, he said after thinking for a bit. The idiot or carpenter line. As bards, we spend a lot of time following people around who we think will have lives worth telling, you know? Yes, many years, while we work on our songs and poems, and if they get killed too soon, we'll have wasted a lot of time and creative effort for very little payout. So, an idiot is someone who takes a lot of risks and relies heavily on luck to win their battles. He'll earn a lot of experience points at first, which will make him think he's doing something right, so he'll undertake even more dangerous quests. But idiots aren't that strong, even if they have a lot of points, because they don't train much. Eventually, his luck will run out, and he'll die, egotistically depriving his bard of new material.
He threw Ed a reproachful look before continuing.
On the other side, we have carpenters. Carpenters are smart people. They have little tolerance for risk, and instead of becoming adventurers, they'll learn a trade and become very skilled at it. Since they take little risk, they'll earn a few experience points, but the kind of talents they need are very cheap anyway. I'm talking resist disease, engrave rune, that sort of thing. Carpenters will make good money, have many children, and with any luck, they'll live to see their grandchildren. But bards won't achieve stardom by singing about the day-to-day of normal, happy, successful people. Idiocy and heroics run hand in hand. Bards need to develop an eye for the idiot or carpenter line and decide what's an acceptable level of idiocy for the adventurers we'll follow. And my bardic instinct tells me that Kess is squarely in the middle of the IC line.
When Alder had finished, Ed could picture his point. He imagined Kess's behavior during a war. She'd never fight alone, always remaining with her squadron. She'd never bite off more than she could chew. She'd retreat when necessary and let reinforcements take her place. All of those actions would take huge chunks out of her experience point pool, but with hard training and good judgment, she'd transform what experience points she earned into a huge increase in power.
That's exactly what I have to do, Ed realized.
He had to learn to transverse the idiot or carpenter line to his own happy middle. Then the mental image he had built of Kess was replaced by a memory of himself rushing headlong into the maws of Barova's mind brood while his friends screamed at him to keep his distance. Ed couldn't help but wonder where Alder placed him in the idiot or carpenter line. Since winter was fast approaching, night came early to Hoya Forest and its inhabitants. Ed spent most of the afternoon going from one part of the encampment to another, making sure the spiders kept a tight perimeter around it while at the same time remaining out of sight of the villagers, who were, understandably, unwilling to let the horned spiders come close to them. He also coordinated with Kleck and the Batblins to count the food they had procured. Ed didn't need many ranks in survival to know that he had a higher population than what the Batblins could feed by foraging, and that he'd need to fix this soon or risk disaster. The rest of the day he spent with Kess, helping her deal with the villagers who wanted to leave the haunt yet couldn't be allowed to. Like Zachary, they were risks to others and themselves,
and if captured by the Inquisition later on, they'd break during interrogation and would bring all the other villagers down with them. And they'd also reveal Ed's location. So Ed had to make sure each villager understood the risks of going to the Inquisition, had a temperament able to keep calm under pressure, and was smart enough to know how to hide in neighboring villages. Kes helped tremendously with the efforts, since she knew almost everyone in Barova and could tell Ed who was trustworthy and who wasn't. In the end, the haunt was left with a couple of village drunks, old people without families to care for them, the infirm, and the weak-minded. They would all need to stay with Ed until he could figure out how to help them. Ed assigned them to Governor Brett, since they used to be under his leadership, and familiarity bred comfort.
A handful of forest critters, a clan of man-eating spiders, and traumatized refugees from a monster attack. And they were all so vulnerable.
Ed felt that if he made the slightest mistake, all these people and intelligent creatures would die. Death came so easily, and although he had always known that, he had never internalized it until he came to Ivalis. Hunger, sickness, cold, all as lethal as a spear through the ribs if left unchecked, not even counting monsters, mind broods, other dungeon lords, or the Inquisition. So many lives were now his responsibility. It was a part of the dungeon lord package that Charon had neglected to mention to him, but it was Ed's weight to carry, nonetheless, and Ed would rather die before failing them. Tomorrow, Ed would start working on his dungeon in full. Besides the food issue and the villagers' problem, he had to prepare for winter. Simply making tunnels and rooms wouldn't cut it anymore. The dungeon needed functioning facilities, like the training center. It needed resources, and defenses, and magic, and a way to generate food, drink, and heat. Ed imagined the dungeon as a living creature, a baby made out of stone and people. It was growing by the day, but as it grew, it hungered. It wanted, needed, more, more, and more, and it was never enough. Ed was sitting atop of it, but if he failed to master the full powers of a dungeon lord, his own creation would devour him and come crashing down over everyone he cared about. And it would be his fault.
"It's like Kes told me," Ed thought that night, in the darkness of his room when he was tucked under his blankets of drone craftsmanship. "I'm committed now, so I may as well go all in."
Sleep took a while to arrive, but it did. His body knew he'd need his strength. Ed woke up in absolute darkness to the smell of decay and the overwhelming feeling that something wicked was headed his way. He barely had time to grab the handle of his short sword, which waited by the side of the bed, then long gray fingers wrenched open the fabric of reality above him. As the hands forced the tear to widen, a featureless head spat forth like the tongue of an invisible aberration tasting the air in search of prey. A familiar headache came over Ed, like myriad screeching voices too far away to understand. Behind the thing's head, Ed could see an apocalyptic storm raging over vast, dark walls that extended beyond the horizon. The creature's eyes tingled with malice. His mouth was frozen in a permanent grin, too wide to be natural and filled with sharp teeth.
"Hi, Ed," the abomination said. "I didn't wake you, did I?"
Ed fought back the cold weight over his lungs and made a titanic effort of will to keep his voice steady.
"Charon, what the hell do you want?"
"I thought I'd come by and check on my good friend Ed Wright,"
Charon said, his voice like a constant screech of nails over chalkboard.
"After all, it's been a while since we last hung out."
Ed looked Murmur's envoy square in his tiny black eyes.
"Fuck off."
"Classic, Ed," Charon said. "No, but seriously, you'll want to hear this. Come here, will ya?"
Without waiting for an answer, an invisible force caught hold of Ed's midsection and propelled him toward the Terran reality, and into Charon's open, waiting hands. Ed glanced at the black marble floor of the Dark Realm. He was flanked by gigantic walls. Through the never-ending storm that consumed the sky above, colossal shapes fought and chased one another. Ed made sure not to look at them directly. Instead, he slashed with his sword. Charon's neck knitted itself back together. It regarded Ed with a wounded expression.
Seriously, Ed?
Ed shrugged and studied his blade, which was covered in unholy ichor.
Had to give it a shot.
Put that thing away before you hurt yourself,
Charon said sternly.
What do you want?
Ed asked. The dungeon lord's throat was dry and his heart raced. In the Dark Realm, he was at the mercy of the creature in front of him. He had seen what Charon was capable of. Not long ago, Charon had torn out Ed's heart in this very place and had replaced it with an organ called the Dungeon Lord's Mantle. It wasn't an experience Ed was willing to repeat. He knew that his sword couldn't harm Charon, but Ed gripped it tight and kept it close to his body, because it was better than nothing.
I want many things, Charon told him. Right now, I'd like for you to get dressed and stop inflicting the sight of your mammalian anatomy on my poor eyes.
If you don't want to see that, you should have called ahead.
Isn't it too cold in Storevos for you to sleep naked?
Charon asked. Every word that came out of that mouth grated on Ed's nerves and fed a hatred so deep that it drowned all fear. He wanted nothing more in the world than to plunge his fingers into those eyes and erase that smile from the monster's face. And he knew he couldn't hurt Charon, no matter how hard he tried. The boatman had erased memories from Ed's head without even a grunt of effort. Ed and Charon were in very different weight classes.
That's going to change one day. You just wait.
The sleeping quarters are next to the fireplace, Ed said. It wasn't as comfortable as he'd have liked, but he couldn't get used to the itch of woolen clothes just yet.
He managed to keep the cold at bay by virtue of a gigantic pile of blankets. As a response, Charon extended an arm that disappeared in the middle of the air as if swallowed by an invisible hole. His hand came back into existence, carrying a pair of leather bracers that Ed recognized as belonging to his own armor ensemble. Charon produced the rest of Ed's clothing and armor one by one until it was all lying in a neat pile.
You'll need it,
was all Charon said as an explanation.
More so because you refuse to use the spell I gave you. Murmur's Reach is one of the favored tools among the Lotian dungeon lords. The longer you spend without figuring out its many uses, the more vulnerable you'll be later.
With Levy's help, Ed had finally cracked what Charon's spell was meant to do, and he didn't like it at all. Murmur's Reach was a control spell that had the dungeon lord leave his body and take possession of one of his minions. If someone killed that minion while the dungeon lord was in control, he simply returned to his original body. The minion, on the other hand, didn't share his luck. It was extremely dark magic, which Ed had no intention of using.
You done? He asked.
Despite his aversion to doing anything that Charon told him to, Ed got dressed without letting the monster out of his sight, because if he had to face Charon, he'd rather do it fully equipped and not naked and vulnerable. Of course, the idea of leather armor doing anything to protect him at all from Charon was as laughable as the concept of hiding from him under a blanket.
To traverse the catacombs,
Charon said. The boatman looked like he was having a jolly good time.
Ah, Ed said.
He refused to indulge Charon by asking him to clarify.
They're filled with undead, from what I've seen, Charon went on. So you'll need to protect your squishy parts from their teeth.
Why the hell, Ed said slowly, would you ever think I'd do anything you wanted me to?
He strapped on the last part of his leather armor. The extra weight over his body did help him feel better about his situation.
You owe me a favor,
Charon said.
It was thanks to me that you saved Alderaan Levy's life the day of your arrival in Ivalis.
Ed made a point of laughing long and hard before telling the boatman to go fuck himself.
As you wish. Guess I'll have to resort to the old yet reliable maiden in trouble gambit.
Charon sighed.
There's a young, innocent woman lost in those catacombs. The people that brought her there want to sacrifice her to power some nasty ritual or another.
Laughter slowly died in Ed's throat. Because firstly, Charon knew him well enough to have a pre-planned maiden-in-trouble gambit, and secondly, It was probably going to work.
And thirdly,
Charon said, reminding Ed that his thoughts were never hidden from the boatman.
Those people are Ranger Ione's friends.
Ed stared at Charon with dawning horror.
Since no one else will come to her aid if you refuse,
Charon went on,
that makes the young maiden's demise in the catacombs more or less your responsibility. But we both know that you decided you'd go long before I started talking. So let's save ourselves the part where you call me names and get on to the action part, shall we?
I have no words to express how much I despise you, Ed said. Bring me back to my dungeon so I can gather everyone. With the combined efforts of Kes, Alder, and Levy, and the horned spiders under Queen Laurel's command, Ed was confident they could make short work of any undead infestation and be back in time for breakfast.
Yes, about that,
Charon said. The abomination at least had the decency to act remorseful, as he said.
I'm sending you alone.
Ed took a brief pause to process this development.
Are you playing with me?
He bellowed.
In this specific instance, no. There are rules, Ed. Rules that even Murmur and the Golden Bitch must abide by. Ones that regulate how much we can interfere in mortal matters. I can't explain those rules to you without causing your brain to melt out of your ears. But the gist of it is, the father of the young lady in trouble made a pact with the Dark a long time ago. That pact now gives me a little wiggle room to send her someone with around the same experience points as her to help her out. I'm choosing you because you're closer than any other suitable agent of the Dark, and because your attitude entertains me. But this is me helping her, Ed. If I helped you by, say, bringing Kessa of Green with you, that'd mean the Light would gain a pass to intervene in some matter of their choice. And the Light would surely think very carefully about how to use their intervention. Probably by sending an Inquisitor worth Kessa's experience points to stop some Heligian orphanage from burning down. And I'd like it very much if the Light didn't do that.
What in the fuck? Ed thought. Then he said, so, you want me to go alone, because otherwise the Light will save an orphanage from burning down? Charon made finger guns and pointed them at Ed.
Yup. Orphans grow into soldiers, you know. And soldiers kill Lotian families during wars, and dead families are families that Lotian dungeon lords can't sacrifice to the Dark God Murmur.
The boatman's body regenerated as fast as Ed's sword pierced it, if not faster than that. Without acknowledging Ed's efforts, Charon calmly drew an invisible circle in the air. The circle became a wound in reality that led to a black passageway badly illuminated by the distant light of a magical torch. The walls were engraved with skulls and bones.
If you think you're angry now, wait until you realize that I'm basically your quest-giver for the evening. Ain't that neat?
Before Ed could react, Charon's long arms caught him by the shoulders and pushed him through the portal with enough force to smack him against the stone wall and have him fall sprawling to the floor in a shower of bone splinters. The boatman closed the portal. He was alone once again. He glanced up at the sky where the others fought their never-ending battle. Then he stretched out his long extremities, groaning with satisfaction.
Ah, how I love my job.
Chapter 5. Catacombs.
Ed dusted himself off and cursed Charon loudly, but the portal had closed the instant Ed had passed through, and he was alone in the passageway. The faint light of the torches drew dancing shadows across the yellowed bones that decorated the ceiling, floor, and walls. It was like the empty cavities of the skulls followed Ed's movements as he tried to gather his bearings. The sensation of being observed was almost overwhelming. He withheld a sneeze. The air smelled of mold and humidity, and Ed could see the particles of dust floating all around him. filled with undead, Ed reminded himself.
He had to move quietly. Behind him was a dead end, so the only way to go was forward. Before that, since he was alone, it'd be best to have his character sheet fresh in his head. Just in case.
Edward Wright.
Species, human. Total experience, 319. Unused experience, 114. Claims, lordship. Attributes. Brawn, 9. Agility, 10. Endurance, 10. Mind, 12. Spirit, 14. Plus 1 Dungeon Lord Mantle, equals 15. Charm, 12. Plus 1 Dungeon Lord Mantle, equals 13. Skills. Athletics. Basic, 6. The owner has trained their body to perform continuous physical activity without penalties to their endurance. For a while. Basic ranks allow them to perform mild, energy-consuming tasks, non-combat, such as running or swimming without tiring. Unlocks stamina-related talents. Untrained combat. Basic, 4. Temporal skill. Can become trained or be improved to open the brawling branch. Dungeon engineering. Basic, 8. The skill represents the user's knowledge of magical constructs pertaining to dungeon craft. As it improves, it opens new rooms and traps, as well as adds to the Dungeon Lord Mantle capacity of storing the user's own blueprints. Combat casting. Basic, 5. Pertains to the speed and efficiency of spells cast during combat or life-threatening situations. Basic status allows the caster to use spells every 20 seconds minus 1 second per extra rank. The caster must say their names aloud and perform the appropriate hand gestures. Leadership. Basic. 5. Reflects the owner's capacity of inspiring and managing his troops and minions. For a dungeon lord, improving the skill adds to the bonus they and their minions receive. Talents. Evil Eye. Allows the dungeon lord to see the objectivity of any creature or item. If the target of their gaze possesses a strong spirit, or related attribute or skill, they may hide their information if the lord's own spirit is not strong enough. Energy drain. Active. Very low. Dungeon Lord Mantle. The mantle is the heart of the dungeon lord and represents the dark pact made in exchange for power. It allows the dungeon lord access to the dungeon lord status and powers as defined by the dungeon screen. It allows the dungeon lord to create and control dungeons as per the limitations of his dungeon screen. Energy drain? None. Improved reflexes. Allows the owner to experience increased reaction time in small bursts. Basic status elevates reaction speed to a degree dictated by the owner's agility for a duration of 3 seconds per use. Energy drain? Activated. High. Resist sickness. Basic. Allows its owner to resist disease and sickness. Basic status allows the owner to resist non-magical sickness as if they had endurance of 15 in optimal conditions. Clean, well-fed, rested. Spellcasting. Basic. 1. Domains. General. Forbidden. Healing. Represents the owner's magical ability. Basic status allows the caster to use and learn all basic-related spells of their domain. Extra ranks improve each individual spell's characteristics, such as range or damage. Allowed spells? 1 basic per day, plus 1 basic spell due to dungeon lordship. Energy drain? Active. Varies per spell. Spell list. Minor order. Command. The caster forces a target creature to follow a simple order as long as said order is not immediately against the creature's moral code or presents a threat to its life. Eldritch Edge. Enchantment. The caster adds a magical flame to the blade of a weapon. This flame makes the weapon magical for the duration, allowing it to bypass weak magical defenses. Duration, 1 minute per spellcraft rank. Murmur's Reach. Command. Mantle. The caster possesses a minion located in the same dungeon as the caster. The caster's body is left defenseless during this time. Duration, 10 minutes per spellcraft rank. That 2 spells per day limitation was getting on his nerves. Levy had explained to him how the spellcasting talent doubled as a skill, in that it also had ranks that could be raised by practice and study. Raising those ranks would earn him more spells per day, But it wasn't easy. Levy herself barely had enough time to gain her first rank before Kale's dungeon went belly up. Ed decided he would add in some magic practice following Kes's training. The combination promised brutal effort, but his magic was currently his best defense against fighters and professional warriors. If he survived tonight, that is. On the other hand, there was something he could do. He had 100 experience points saved up, and last time he checked, he'd earned a couple interesting options. Since there had been no reason to spend the points, he'd been reluctant to use them until he had raised his attributes and skills. But Charon had changed the circumstances.
"I'll have to buy a couple talents after I figure out what I'm up against," Ed decided.
He went down the passageway, ignoring the skulls and the bones, sword at the ready. What could he expect of Ivalian undead? When he had played Ivalis online, he had cleared one or two undead-themed dungeons. There had been a mid-level vampire dungeon lord that had killed his friend Mark's first character and resurrected it as a thrall.
"I really hope that Charon didn't throw me into a vampire lair without proper equipment," Ed thought.
If there were vampires in the catacombs, he was as good as dead. Besides the many powers a vampire had, they were heavily resistant to normal types of damage. Ed had no blessed or magical weapons, and as a dungeon lord, he doubted he could call the light gods for help. From what he could recall, the variety within undead was immense. Whites, zombies, skeletons, flesh golems, vampires, wraiths, specters, liches, mummies, and a very long etc. All undead shared the same basic array of weaknesses. They took extra damage from fire, sunlight harmed them in varying degrees, they were vulnerable to holy magic and silver weaponry, but they also shared a few special powers. For example, they were immune to fear, couldn't be sneak attacked, could see in the dark, and were more powerful in it. If Charon had given him a warning, Ed would have at least ordered his drones to scour the hills for silver ore. With Yorche's help, maybe Ed could have improved his short sword to hurt undead. The boatman's decision to send him in without any kind of backup had limited Ed's options greatly. He'd need to find the woman, locate the exit with her help, and get the hell out of Dodge while avoiding combat altogether. The passageway brought Ed in front of a door. The door was reinforced with thick iron bars and secured by a heavy lock. A quick examination revealed that Ed could open the lock without a key. It was broken. Ed's other option, besides trying the door, would be to keep following the corridor and see where it led. Following gamer logic everywhere, Ed decided that the evidence of danger meant he was on the right track and opened the door. He saw a cramped room with old, broken coffins strewn in rows. The air carried rot and was heavy with dust. Also, about 6 corpses stood stupidly in the middle of the chamber, staring at nothing with their empty eye sockets. Their bodies were partially mummified, old and dry and with the leathery skin barely covering the bone, which was exposed in some parts. Ed saw ribs and spines, but no internal organs. They had rotted away long ago. The zombies turned as one toward the sound of the door opening, and Ed found himself staring eye to socket with one of the undead beings. Stiff extremities rose in his direction. A terrible groan rasped out of dead throats, and mouths opened to reveal black and yellow teeth without a tongue in sight. As one, the 6 creatures shuffled in Ed's direction. Ed, with deliberate movements, closed the door as softly and as firmly as he could. Then he added his weight to the wooden frame.
"Fuck everything about this," he said.
Intellectually, he had been exposed to the concept of zombies since he was little. Like many people his age, he had fantasized a couple times about surviving the zombie apocalypse, facing hordes of undead armed only with a shotgun and a baseball bat, and living from the land while protecting entire towns of scantily clad women. He had killed thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of undead while playing video games. He had seen them get mowed down by the score in movies. He had been exposed so often to the concept of zombies that he had lost the fear of them. They were jokes nowadays, or props for low-budget movies. He glanced at his hands and tried to will them to stop shaking.
"They're only zombies," he thought.
But seeing a zombie in pop culture was one thing. Another very different thing was to stumble across a bunch of reanimated corpses in real life. The idea of zombies hadn't come out of nowhere. Since the dawn of time, mankind had been exposed to death and feared it. The sight of a corpse produced an instinctual reaction, deep within the reptilian part of the brain, that screamed wrongness and danger. The kind of fear awakened by the sight of the dead wasn't the kind that could be shrugged off by clenched teeth and a motivational speech. It was a statement, not a suggestion. It admitted no arguments.
The corridor it is, Ed thought.
He heard the distant clash of metal against metal, and screams. Battle screams, punctuated here and there by the unmistakable sound of agony. The noise came from the other end of the zombie-infested room and didn't seem far off. Charon had told Ed that an innocent woman would die here without his help. Ed glanced at the corridor. The sounds of battle intensified. Was he willing to risk an innocent life because he was scared? On the other hand, and this was almost as horrifying as the zombies, Ed realized that Charon's decision to motivate him with a maiden-in-distress gambit was about to work flawlessly.
"Fuck," Ed said.
He smashed the door open to reveal the dry husk of a man nose-to-nose with him, dead mouth hungering for living flesh.
"Fuck!"
Ed punched it in the face. The zombie collapsed like a sack of bricks, and Ed vaulted over the creature. The other five stood close by, a wall of arms and open hands extended in Ed's direction.
"Fuck!"
Ed dodged and darted to the right. He grabbed the extended hand of the rightmost zombie and pulled the creature toward him, then he punched it square in the jaw. The zombie didn't go down, and the impact almost broke Ed's wrist. He stepped toward the zombie and shoved him. Was it even a him? Into the others. Instead of the zombies going down, like Ed had hoped, the creatures acted as a cushion for each other, and the monster in front of Ed merely took a startled step back before grabbing Ed by the forearms with an iron-like grip.
"Fuck!"
Ed pushed and shoved the zombie away as hard as he could, then dragged himself away from the remaining creature's reach. He fought the zombie while teeth snapped inches away from his nose. The undead wasn't as strong as Ed, but it was tenacious, and Ed couldn't make it let go no matter how hard he tried. Whiteness threatened to drown his vision, and Ed realized he was about to lose his mind to panic. He stumbled against a coffin and fell, bringing the zombie with him. Ed's left wrist burned when the zombie managed to get a lucky chomp as they fell.
"Fuck!"
Ed used his leather bracers to fill the creature's mouth and push the dead face away from him. Zombie and man rolled on the floor while the other undead shuffled their way, trying stupidly to wade through the coffins.
"You faced death before,"
Ed desperately reminded himself. Long before coming to Ivalis, he had seen Uncle Jonah's torn body as the morticians had stitched it back together. When he was older, he had buried his parents, one after the other, and had been left to fend for himself in an uncaring world. And he had faced death when he had driven a flaming sword deep into the open maws of a mind brood. This low-leveled mob was nothing in comparison. Green light danced on the undead's face as Ed activated his evil eye. The cold anger of the mantle drowned the screeches of the reptilian part of his brain. Fear of death may have been an absolute statement for any man, but Ed wasn't just a man anymore. He was a dungeon lord.
"Release me,"
he ordered the zombie, his voice emanating with power and authority. The zombie let go of him instantly as if struck by lightning. His eye sockets glared at Ed scornfully, as if demanding an explanation. Turns out that the minor order spell worked flawlessly against a being with barely any spirit attribute. Ed stood up, picked up his sword from the floor, and turned to the rest of the zombies as they approached. He glanced down and walked away from the group while he counted in his head.
1, 2, 3...
When he reached 16 seconds, he felt the magical energies of his body focus once again.
"Eldritch Edge!"
Tongues of green flame emerged from Ed's sword hand and enveloped the blade in an inferno of arcane energy. Now he reclaimed the ground that he had given. The zombie that had bitten him was still down.
"Perfect."
Ed brought the weapon down hard atop the fallen zombie's head. The impact splintered the undead's skull and collapsed it like a clay sphere crushed with a hammer. The creature convulsed and rolled on the floor as the necromantic energies that animated him left his body. The spell Eldritch Edge enchanted the blade as a magical weapon and added fire damage to it, and undead were both vulnerable to magic and weak against fire. And the best part? The spell lasted for an entire minute. The rest of the zombies shuffled his way. Ed received them with a welcoming smile. Green flames danced over his head when he raised his sword, and he felt the magical heat on his skin as he brought the blade down against the nearest monster. The strike hit true and sent the creature sprawling down as green fire caught and began to spread on the rotten cloth that covered the zombie's body. Ed lacked Kess's technique or strength, but he had played America's pastime enough to know how to hit hard with a baseball bat, and a human head bobbling slowly up and down made for a much easier target than a fastball. Ed swung over and over again, bringing a zombie down with each strike. Green flames spread over dead flesh and collapsed wood. Shadows danced in the walls of the ossuary. A mummified woman managed to crawl unnoticed to Ed's feet and took a hard bite, which was thankfully deflected by Ed's leather armor. Ed swung his sword down like a mace and caved the zombie's skull in. His shoulders burned with effort when the Eldritch Edge spell ended 60 seconds after its activation. The magical flames that threatened to burn down the room died, too, leaving a dense cloud of smoke over the charred remains of bodies and wood. There was no movement left in the chamber but Ed's, and the only sound was that of his ragged breathing. He glanced at the arcane letters that formed in front of him as the objectivity informed him of the value of his efforts. You have gained 5 experience. 0 × 6 zombies, 5 for surviving your first encounter with an undead ambush. Your unused experience is 114, and your total experience is 319. Your untrained combat skill has increased by 1 rank. Your combat casting skill has increased by 1 rank. 5 experience points. He had almost been eaten alive by reanimated corpses, and yet objectivity had judged that the risk he'd incurred was barely worth noticing. 5 experience points. He examined the charred remains of the nearest zombie, using his evil eye to display the stats in front of him. Newborn zombie, human. Experience, 5. Brawn, 3. Agility and spirit, 1. Endurance, 5. Mind, 1. Charm, 3. Skills. Untrained combat. Basic, 5. Move silently. Basic, 10. Tracking. Basic, 5. Talents. Pack tactics. Undead. Ed laughed through gritted teeth. It was a bitter laugh, without any humor in it. The objectivity wasn't wrong. It was never wrong. Zombies should have been a trivial task for him, because he was worth 60 times more experience than each one of them. Objectivity cared little about the feelings of men when faced with the horror of death. It only knew of the raw truth of numbers. Numbers would never lie to him, but fear would. Had he allowed himself to be consumed by his fear, he'd have been doomed.
Never again, Ed swore.
He glanced at his wounded hand. A tiny wound, nothing more than a scrape and a few drops of blood. And yet, it was a zombie bite.
Oh, shit, Ed thought.
They wore red robes. Charon had told her that they were freedom fighters or some such nonsense, but the fact of the matter was, they wore red robes. They had daggers. They stared at her with unfocused eyes, frothing at the mouth, their faces constricted by maddened rage.
Rebels my ass,
Catalin thought as she dodged the swipe of her nearest attacker.
Ask someone in Lotia, ask someone in Plekth. They'll all say the same thing. Red robes, daggers, and weird-ass rituals equal cultists. It's not hard to get right.
She rolled across the floor, darted like a deer to avoid the man who tried to rush her down, and then used the wall to change directions. A judicious application of her feline acrobatics talent allowed her to vault over the third and last cultist's head and land out of his reach, closer to the door than any of them. Just as she had planned. Now she only had to deal with the zombie guarding her exit. Hard to do with three assholes trying to stab her.
"Stay still, bitch!"
one of them said, spewing spit with every word. He was broader in the shoulders than the others and had a brawn score of 14. It'd be a bad idea to let him get a hold of her, so she swung her knife in a wide arc to discourage him from getting closer. She had stolen her knife from the fourth member of their little group, who was now lying in a pool of his own blood after Catalin had hit him with a silver vessel. She had stolen the vessel when she had disrupted the ritual downstairs, which had prompted this group to give chase. She enjoyed stealing from these assholes, and now she was going to steal from them the greatest prize of them all, her own hide. Behind her, the zombie slowly shuffled her way. The other two cultists realized this and exchanged knowing glances. They kept their distance and simply watched like kids going to their first bardic theater play. Catalin could have laughed in their faces, but didn't. They had paid to know her full character sheet. They knew she had the alert talent, which made her immune to this sort of situation. It was amazing how little attention people paid to obvious things.
"I could stay still,"
Catalin told the burly man.
"But then I wouldn't be able to benefit from my advanced dodge talent, and you wouldn't believe how many experience points I paid for it."
The cultist's eyes darted to the point behind her where the zombie was probably about to take a good chunk out of her neck. Her alert talent filled her head with the metaphorical screech of a bell, and the skin of her back tried its best to stand on end, despite lacking any kind of fur. Catalin smiled beatifically and activated feline acrobatics again. The effort of its continued use made her vision blur for an instant, but the training of the Thieves Guild allowed her endurance to tank the energy expenditure. The thief dropped down an instant before a pair of putrid hands attempted to clamp down on her neck. She rolled to the side and then jumped back while leaving her leg in front of the zombie, who stared stupidly at the space where she had once been and perhaps wondered where his food had gone. Catalin slapped the undead creature in the back, which prompted him to take a step forward. The zombie barely had enough agility to stand without help, so it immediately lost balance and tripped in an almost comical way across the room, and straight into the stunned arms of the burly cultist.
"Dunghill!"
the cultist said. He tried to dodge, but green and brown hands encircled his torso as the zombie tried to regain balance. Then, undead instincts took over, and the monster took a chomp out of the man's neck. Blood sprayed like a fountain, and both figures went down in a crimson frenzy of arms and legs.
"That's way more violent than I thought it'd be,"
Catalin said softly. She was going to relive that image in her nightmares.
"Robert!"
one of the remaining cultists said.
"No!"
He jumped toward his friend, tears in his eyes, and fought against the zombie, trying to save the dying man. To no avail. As he did so, the third cultist fixated his eyes on Catalin.
"You'll pay for this."
"Really?"
Catalin asked.
"You tried to sacrifice me to that monster from your ritual and I'm the bad guy? Honey, you did this to yourself."
"Die, you bitch!"
The man raised his knife and tensed his body, preparing to charge her. Catalin could have run away right then and there, but now she was annoyed. Maybe she'd stab the man a bit before leaving.
"On the other hand, I don't want whatever is in the lower levels to catch up with me."
The point was rendered moot when her alert talent warned her of a presence behind her. The door opened, and a man with a short sword entered the room. The cultist with the knife stopped in his tracks just as Catalin instinctively leapt away from the newcomer and positioned herself with her back against the wall, as far away as possible from everyone else. The newcomer's thousand-yard stare made Catalin think that he was, somehow, having a worse day than hers. He regarded the cultists with a distant expression. The man was in his mid-20s, tall and gaunt, with unruly black hair caked to his forehead by sweat. He was dressed in the bare-bones leather armor of a town watchman, but something about his demeanor told her he wasn't a guard. She glanced at his feet. Then she understood.
"You're the guy Haron was going to send,"
she said.
"And you're the maiden in distress, I presume?" he asked.
"I'm neither of those things,"
Catalin said happily. The man sighed.
"Of course."
Catalin had seen that very same expression in petty thieves who were about to hang.
"How about you give me a hand with these dung for brains?"
At their mention, the two remaining cultists recovered from their surprise. The second one forgot about the zombie and his friend Robert,
who wasn't moving anymore, and brandished his dagger against the newcomer.
A guard! Quick, Martin! Kill him before he shouts for help!
They took a couple steps in. The newcomer raised